Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 15th of December. We talk this hour about the man who wasn't Darwin, Alfred Russel Wallace, who charted a great dividing line in the living world and found his own route to the theory of evolution. It's the title of a very interesting piece in the current issue, December issue of National Geographic magazine. And we speak with National Geographic contributing writer David Quammen about Alfred Russel Wallace this hour. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, it's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. David, thank you very much for joining us. It's a fascinating article. Yeah. You know what's interesting is that I bet you if you took a survey of people, what do you think? 99% would have no idea who Alfred Russel Wallace was?
I think that's probably right. Yes. Yeah. Scholars are aware of him, but if you ask the average person who came up with the idea of evolution by natural selection, they would say Charles Darwin, and Alfred Russel Wallace would be omitted from the picture completely.
I know. Poor Alfred. Although he probably didn't mind, but poor Alfred.
Yeah, he's among science historians, he's sort of famous for being forgotten.
Exactly. His story, you would think that he would be remembered simply because of his story. It's a fascinating life the guy led.
It is. He's a wonderful scientific hero. And yeah, the narrative of his life story is something that, a Victorian novelist might have come up with, but it's really the truth.
Right. So give us, a brief narrative. Well, we got an hour. We can give more than a brief narrative.
But give us the very bare outline is here's a fellow about 20 years younger than Charles Darwin who came from a family with no money, left school and went to work at the age of 14, but became fascinated with the natural world and in particular became fascinated with the question of where species come from. He found a way to go to South America, to the Amazon basin, to explore this question by collecting species of butterflies, birds, mammals, all sorts of specimens, and paid his way by shipping these specimens back to London, where an agent sold them to private collectors and to museums. And he had to pay his way as a commercial collector because, as I say, he didn't have family money as Charles Darwin had had 20 years earlier when he went on the voyage of the Beagle and had a chance to see the world. So Wallace spends 4 years in the Amazon basin, living a very hard life, moving up and down the river in dugout canoes, eating the local food, suffering the local miseries, insect bite and tropical rot, and amasses a large collection of specimens. He is then sailing home in 1852 with this great cache, and the boat that he's on catches fire and sinks in the Atlantic.
Can you believe it? Oh, my gosh.
He manages to survive in a lifeboat, finally gets back to England, limps ashore, and vows that if he can help it, he'll never set foot on a boat on the ocean again. But very quickly, he decides that although he's lost all of his specimens, he wants to go back out and try again to approach this question of where species come from. This time he goes to the east, to a world of islands known then as the Malay Archipelago, most of which is what we now know as the country of Indonesia, and he spends 8 years out there traveling from island to island, again by native boats, collecting birds of paradise and fantastic birdwing butterflies and giant beetles and other sorts of specimens, and continuing to wonder about this question. What explains the origin of all this biological diversity and the way these creatures are distributed from one island to another in space? What became known as the science of biogeography, which species live where and why? Finally, one day in a malarial fever, he comes up with the idea of essentially evolution by natural selection. He didn't use those terms, And no one had published this idea at that point. Darwin had been working on it for 20 years, but Darwin had kept it a secret. So Wallace then writes a manuscript describing this idea, and he sends this by mail to the one person back in London among respected scientists who had been a little bit friendly to him, Mr. Charles Darwin. Hmm. So that's how the co-discovery occurred.
And how did Darwin respond when he got this letter? He knew he was onto the same thing. He was somewhat generous in saying, well, let's announce this together, right?
Well, I would say no. I mean, I love Darwin dearly. I've written about him as much as I've written about Wallace. But generous is the wrong word for Darwin's reaction. Darwin was he was heartstruck when he got this letter. You can just imagine him slapping himself in the forehead and saying, ay, 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 I delayed too long. I was too much of a perfectionist. I was too cautious. I waited 20 years, and now this other guy, this nobody, has come up with my theory of evolution. There's a quote in one of his letters, all my originality, whatever it might be worth, has been smashed.
Oh.
And he made this complaint to two of his close scientific friends, a botanist named Joseph Hooker, the great geologist Charles Lyell. And he told them, oh, no, I'm honor-bound now to help this young fellow get his paper published, but it destroys all of my originality. Oh, poor me, poor me. And they said, Charlie, calm down. Maybe we can arrange something that's fair and that preserves your originality, your discovery, as well as doing credit to this young fellow. Because Darwin had shared his idea with these two men. They mm-hmm. knew he had already been developing this idea, although no one else knew that. So then they arranged for a joint reading of Wallace's paper and some excerpts from Darwin's unpublished work at a meeting of a scientific society, the Linnaean Society, on the evening of July 1st, 1858. And that then became the date point for priority on this discovery, and it was Wallace and Darwin sharing it.
Hmm. And what was Alfred's response then? Did he feel that he got it first and he smacked himself in the head as well, or what did he
Wallace
think?
Was amazing on this, and the word you used earlier, generous, does apply to Wallace.
Hmm.
Wallace was not consulted about this joint announcement. He was way out of the loop. He was still in the Malay Archipelago, but he heard about it afterwards. And when he heard about it, he was delighted. He thought, well, I've been put on a level with the great naturalist Charles Darwin. Darwin was famous at that point, but he had been famous as a very conventional naturalist. So this was a great breakthrough for young Alfred Wallace. He suddenly was being considered a scientific peer and colleague of people like Charles Darwin and Charles Lyell, Joseph Hooker. And he thought, great, I'll take that. That's much better than I had reason to hope for. So I'm perfectly delighted to share this discovery.
Hmm. There's a striking – let's talk about his collections for a moment. There's a striking picture. I guess I never really thought a whole lot in my life about the variety of beetles. And there are so many different colors and shapes and sizes of beetles. Why did Wallace collect all these beetles?
Well, one of the reasons he collected beetles was because there are a lot of beetles in England. So when he got started as a naturalist, as a very young man, and hadn't yet gone off to the Amazon, he could collect beetles. And he was amazed at the variety of beetles that could be found just in the vicinity of the city of Leicester in central England. Darwin also had started as a beetle collector in England.
Mm-hmm.
But when you expand to the tropics, to the New World and the Old World tropics, then you find there is just an amazing diversity of beetles. As a matter of fact, this is one of the famous natural history facts that you hear about sometimes. There are more species of beetles than any other order of insect. There's something like 300,000 species.
Oh, my gosh, you're kidding.
Of beetles, and probably another million or 2 million that are yet to be identified.
No.
As a matter of fact, there's a famous quote from a later biologist, J.B.S. Haldane, a 20th century geneticist and socialist and agnostic. And someone once asked him, well, Dr. Haldane, what does your study of the natural world tell you about the nature of our creator? This was a clergyman who asked him. And Haldane's famous answer was, well, it shows that he had an inordinate fondness for beetles.
Yes. So why are there so many beetles, David?
People are still trying to figure that out. There's a certain body pattern that characterizes all beetles of the order Coleoptera, and for some reason that body pattern, the fact of having hard wing covers over more delicate underwings instead of having four delicate wings like butterflies or flies do, there's something that seems to be just extraordinarily successful, effective, and flexibly adaptable about that body pattern.
Interesting. So you talk about he was in this malaria-induced fever, and he comes up with this, you know, remarkable idea. You get this image, and I wish there were a movie done about this. What do these people do? Do they just, they've done all these collections, and you're just spending a lot of the day after you've been out collecting things thinking about this? That you're, how do you come up with this this theory? Why was it important that it came out of a malaria-induced fever or not?
He was prepared, so it wasn't just this brilliant stroke of imaginative insight in the midst of his fever. He had prepared himself with a couple of forms of data and reading. He had studied the patterns of species distribution around the Malay archipelago and also earlier in the Amazon. He had seen that closely allied species tended to exist next to one another in space and also in time in the fossil record, that closely allied species, by which he simply meant similar species, were juxtaposed, and he wondered, what did that mean? He had also read a book by Thomas Malthus, Essay on the Principle of Population, published earlier, that talked about the fact that more individuals are born than can be supported by the amount of food and habitat available. Malthus is talking mostly about human poverty and struggle, but Wallace read this book, and Darwin had also read it earlier, and for each of them, the reading of Malthus was something that that sensitized them to the idea that there were always more individuals born than can survive, so that there was a struggle for survival. Wallace now, in his malarial fever, put these elements together. And then suddenly, bingo, eureka, he got the insight. If there are more individuals born than can survive, and if individuals vary from one another by in minute ways, even within a given species, then only some can survive, and those that survive must be the best adapted. In other words, the survival of the fittest.
Hmm. Isn't that something? Wouldn't you love to have, maybe you already have, one of those eureka moments? Ah, I have this great insight.
Yeah, I would love that. I haven't had anything like this.
I haven't either. Well, just this beetle news is something for all of us. It's a striking thought. It must be one thing to do this kind of work when you have family supporting you and some money supporting you, and quite another to be a guy who left school very young, not a strong education, and not a lot of financial support. He was living in out-of-the-way places by himself and getting sick and not having the kind of support that I would imagine a lot of scientists needed in those days, David.
Absolutely, and that's one of the things that makes him a great character. That's one of the things I love about him. He was an impecunious freelancer from the very beginning. No money, lots of enterprise, lots of self-confidence, no social support, no fancy education. And actually, Kathleen, ironically, it was one of the things that helped him get to this theory, this breakthrough insight, by a shorter path than Darwin himself had taken. Because Wallace was a commercial collector, he had to collect multiple specimens, or he wanted to collect multiple specimens, of each of the most decorative, the most impressive, the most saleable species that he found. So when he found a species of bird of paradise on a remote island in the Malay archipelago, he didn't just want one or two specimens of that bird of paradise. He wanted as many as he could get to keep a couple for his own collection and to sell the rest to support himself. So he would get 12 or 15, likewise with a very decorative birdwing butterfly. He would collect in abundance. And then he would have those individuals of a single species before him as he prepared them for shipping. And he would see something that I just alluded to earlier, which is that individuals within the given species vary from one another by tiny incremental differences. And those differences within a species are the raw material on which natural selection, the engine of evolution, works. So Wallace, because he was a commercial collector, had the necessity for multiple specimens and therefore the occasion to see and be impressed by this intra-specific variation. And that was crucial to him.
Yeah. And you talked about him giving these to, or selling them to museums. Did he come up with a whole list of people before he set off to these parts unknown and said, did he sign contracts with them? I'm gonna sell you this.
No, and this is another nice part of the story. He found an agent. He found a man on Bloomsbury Street in London named Samuel Stevens, who himself I think we could consider an unsung scientific hero. He was the man who became the agent and the broker for Wallace's specimens. So from the Amazon and then later from the Malay archipelago, Wallace was shipping his specimens carefully packaged and crated back to Samuel Stevens on Bloomsbury Street, who was then shopping them around to the museums and to the private scientific collectors who purchased them and paid Wallace's way. And this relationship with Samuel Stevens endured through all of his travels, his 4 years in the Amazon, his 8 years in the Malay archipelago. Samuel Stevens back in London was his lifeline.
And did he keep a diary of what was going on every day?
He did, and that was one of the things from his years in the Amazon that he lost when that ship caught fire and sank. He lost his journals from 4 years of exploration and observation in the Amazon. And then he kept a journal also in the Malay archipelago. And after he got back to England and had a chance to dry out and heal his infected feet and get married and father a couple of children, finally he published a book, a great book, based on his Malay journals, which became titled The Malay Archipelago. And it's one of the great books of scientific exploration and natural history from the 19th century, The Malay Archipelago by Alfred Wallace.
I want to talk about a couple of the pictures that are in the magazine. I don't know how to pronounce this, but I've never seen this bird before. And some of these pictures, you're well known for this in the magazine, but you can just look at this animal and say, oh, my gosh, I could look at this animal forever. The cassowaries?
The cassowary. Yeah, a beautiful image by my partner and colleague in this essay, Rob Clark, who did the photographs. That's a large flightless bird that's native only to the island. There are a couple of different species of cassowary, native only to Australia and New Guinea. And that's where it was in some of the offshore islands from New Guinea that Wallace would have seen cassowaries.
The color in this is just so amazing.
It's a formidable looking creature, you know, glowering out at us there, isn't it?
It sure is. Let's welcome phone calls for you. David Quammen is our guest, National Geographic contributing writer who has written extensively about the man who wasn't Darwin, Alfred Russel Wallace. He's also quite a Darwin scholar as well. But the article in this month's National Geographic is the story of Alfred Russel Wallace, a British naturalist who wrote on the origin of new species and the survival of the fittest and was coming to his conclusions the same time Darwin was, and they published a paper together. And it's interesting to look at the routes they took to come up with this remarkable theory and groundbreaking theory, and how each man took the other's news that they had discovered the same thing. So at any rate, it's in the current issue, December issue of National Geographic. And we welcome your phone calls. Our number, I'm sure that many of you are very familiar, more familiar than I was, with the story of Alfred Russel Wallace. We welcome your phone calls, and here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Should you care to send an email, that would be fine, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Phone lines are open for you now. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up this hour of tomorrow's program here on the Ideas Network, John Meacham will join us. John is the editor of Newsweek magazine and has written a wonderful book about Andrew Jackson, and it's titled American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. So John is with us tomorrow during our 10 o'clock hour. Okay, let's go to phone calls. David Quantum, National Geographic contributing writer. He's written extensively on Alfred Russel Wallace and also on Darwin, is our guest. Our number 800-486-8655. And we start with Pam from Madison. Hi, Pam.
Morning.
Hi.
Hi, I have a question. Given that science itself is always evolving, if Darwin and Wallace today showed up with their work as new science, would they get heard? How would they break through and get heard?
Huh.
Well, they would get heard, I would say, by publishing in a scientific journal, first of all, which is essentially what they did when these papers were read jointly to a scientific society in 1858. And then it might take a period of time for a really radical important but revolutionary idea like evolution by natural selection was to take hold. That happens even today. Something is published in a scientific journal, and a few scientists may read it, and it may sort of slowly gather attention and adherence, but doesn't necessarily happen instantaneously. And it didn't happen instantaneously with them either. I mean, one question that could be asked in addition, Pam, to the one that you asked is, well, if Darwin and Wallace jointly made this announcement, published this idea in 1858 before the Linnaean Society, why did Wallace not end up with a half share of the credit? Why has he been forgotten by the general public? And the reason is that their technical publications, their technical announcement, didn't really register with a large number of people. It was a little bit too technical, and nothing much happened until Darwin himself then sat down and in a flurry of activity wrote the quick and dirty book version of the theory that he had been working on for 20 years and published that a year later under the title On the Origin of Species. So it was the book, The Origin of Species, that really made this idea take hold, and not these more technical, more concise, a little bit more lapidary presentations that had been made to the Linnaean Society. Hmm. So it's a combination of things. It's getting to the idea first, having evidence to support it, publishing it, sometimes in a relatively obscure place. But then there's a broader campaign sometimes required to sell the idea to the entire scientific community, let alone to the general public.
Hmm. Wow, that's perfect. Thank you.
Yes, thanks so much for the call. I'm thinking, I guess it's mostly in the areas of space, or maybe I just pay special attention to space stories. But it seems to me as though the way we get a lot of this news, at least about space and perhaps other things, is on television these days, too. And sometimes these remarkable things, discovery of another solar system, et cetera, are just put in a sentence at the end of a newscast. And I always want to say, I do, wait a second, give me more about this. And then you have to go to the internet to find out more about it. It's such a huge discovery sometimes, and it's never fully explained.
Right, right. I think about that, too. I hear something about, well, scientists have announced that it turns out that dark matter constitutes 80% of the universe, and we're trying to figure out in what ways dark matter affects the physics of what we see by way of visual light. And I hear that, and I think, well, which scientists announced that, and how did they figure this out, and is there any way I could just spend the next week learning about that?
Yeah, I'm with you. Right. Thanks, Pam, very much for an interesting call. Bruce from Eau Claire. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. I've got a couple of questions, I guess, a little bit off the subject, but could you speak a little bit about what the scientific thinking was prior to the release of Wallace and Darwin's theories? And number two, could you speak a little bit to the religious reaction to the release of Wallace's and Darwin's theories during that period of time.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I'll take my answer off the air.
And this is an important part of the whole context. You're right. First of all, before Darwin and Wallace came along, there were the general understanding of the origins of life's diversity, the origins of species, were going to give it a label, you'd give it the label special creations. The idea was held that God had individually created every species with a special act of creation and put them down in the various places around the planet where we find them. That was the theory of special creations, and that was generally held not just by clergymen, but by most scientists of the early 19th century when Wallace and Darwin began their work. And it's important to recognize, some people say, well, when Darwin came along, or Darwin and Wallace came along, it was science versus religion. What you have to recognize is that science and religion, particularly in 19th century England, were very closely connected, were closely allied. Most of the scientists who had been Darwin's teachers, for instance, in Edinburgh and later in Cambridge University, most of the scientists, geologists, botanists, natural historians, themselves were ordained Anglican clergymen. So there was an alliance, an establishment alliance between the Anglican Church and the people, most of them were men, who were doing natural history, geology, science. So when Darwin and Wallace proposed their idea, this materialistic explanation of how species arose, they were going not just against religious beliefs, but against the broad intellectual and religious convictions of most of the scientists of the time. And then the reaction to Darwin and Wallace, and in particular to Darwin's Origin of Species, was loud and very mixed. Some scientists and members of the general public reacted by saying, "Oh my gosh, this is it. This is the answer, the persuasive and satisfying answer to a question that we hadn't even been smart enough to be asking." And then others, including some scientists, said, "This is baloney. This is gobbledygook. This is unsupported by evidence, let alone heretical." And there was a very negative reaction to it, off and on, for 20 or 30 years. And then eventually other pieces of evidence were developed and fell into place so that it became impossible, essentially, for scientists to reject this idea, although some religious people, off and on over the last 150 years, have continued to choose to reject it.
Right. It's amazing to me that people still reject it, isn't it? People still reject this.
It is amazing, and it's a matter of faith. I mean, essentially, they choose to say, "Well, I would rather believe the voices in my own heart and the voices in my church and a literal interpretation of the Bible and Revelation, than believe the evidence that has been presented by scientists over the past 150 years. But then other very religious people say, "Well, I don't find a conflict between these two views, and I can reconcile them in my mind just fine."
Right. Thank you, Bruce, so much for your call. 800-486-8655. Our number, Brian, is next from Rochester, Minnesota. Hi, Brian.
Good morning. My question is, what was Darwin and Wallace's understanding of the mechanism at the cellular or genetic level? Did they have any hint or clue of exactly what was creating the small changes that they were seeing, or did that come much later?
That's a really good question, Brian. They didn't know what was creating this intraspecific variation. They had no theory of inheritance. Well, Darwin later proposed a theory of inheritance in one of his later books. He called it pangenesis. But what they didn't have was an understanding of genetics, the way inheritance actually works with with one form of a gene coming from, in sexual reproduction at least, one form of a gene coming from the mother, one form coming from the father, and then those two forms of the gene interacting, one of them being dominant, one of them being recessive, at least in most cases, to determine a particular trait. They didn't have that. They didn't have any of that. That was discovered quietly by an Augustinian monk named Gregor Mendel and published again in an obscure scientific journal in what then was what later became Czechoslovakia in 1865, but Darwin didn't read it. Wallace didn't read it. Nobody read it, so nobody knew about Mendelian genetics until it was rediscovered in about 1900. If they had, they would have been able to present a more persuasive explanation, not just for evolution by natural selection, but by the way genetics works to generate the intraspecific variation that's the raw material that natural selection works on. So they had to do without that. They had to work with a big area of ignorance.
I never realized that it took 35 years for Mendel's work to be recognized.
It did, yeah, 35 years. And then it was rediscovered by a couple of different scientists in about 1900.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call. Let's go next to Rich. Hi, Rich. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Hi.
I just wanted to mention earlier, maybe it was in the 70s, an anthropologist by the name of Lauren Isley wrote a book called Darwin and the Mysterious Mr. X, which was about some of the other evolutionists at that time, but it was weighted heavily toward Wallace, and you know, he tried to popularize the fact that Wallace was just as significant or this this big figure at the same time as Darwin, and that history has kind of lost him. And I wanted to ask your guest, how big a role the social Darwinist or the social evolutionist that came before this played Wallace versus Darwin. That's all I got for you today.
Rich, all right, thank you.
I'm not sure what you mean, Rich, by the social evolutionists who came before Wallace and Darwin, but I'll take a stab at it. There were evolutionary theorists before, even before Darwin and Wallace. There was Jean-Baptiste Lamarck in France, who published some writings around the turn of the 19th century, the beginning of the 19th century, and he also proposed the idea that that species evolve, that organisms, species change from one form into another. He didn't have a rational, persuasive mechanism. He didn't have natural selection, although he had the idea of evolution. And Darwin had read Lamarck, and Charles Lyell had read Lamarck, and they thought it was crackpot stuff. Because he didn't have that that rational physical mechanism. And then there were others, and I think Lauren Isley, who you mentioned, talked about some of them in that Mysterious Mr. X book, in addition to Wallace. There was a fellow named Patrick Matthew, who had actually sketched the idea of evolution by natural selection 20 or 25 years before Darwin and Wallace, but he did it very inconspicuously in a book on naval timber and tree farming. And he didn't really know himself how important this idea was, and so it just lay there and was never recognized. And after Darwin and Wallace published, then Patrick Matthew came forward and said, "Hey, what about me, guys? I look back at my 1830 book. I had this idea." And Darwin said, "Well, son of a gun, you did, but you didn't make us understand how important and far-reaching this idea was." So yes, the idea was there earlier, at least of evolution in general, and in the case of Patrick Matthew, the idea of evolution by natural selection. But it hadn't been presented in an overwhelmingly persuasive way as it was eventually in The Origin of Species.
How would the lives, do you think, David, of both Wallace and Darwin have played out differently if Wallace had, a great publicist and his idea came to the forefront first? And Darwin's, as you called him, being a perfectionist, he just wasn't ready. They may have had it at about the same time, but Wallace got there first.
Well, I think that the best way for me to answer that is with the answer that Wallace himself gave. Wallace gave huge credit to Darwin all throughout his life. He was never bitter about Darwin becoming more famous. He venerated Darwin, and he said, look, all I had when I came up with my paper, came up with the theory and put it into that paper that I mailed to Darwin, all I had was the bare outline of the idea, the mechanism. Darwin already had 20 years of careful data gathering, refining and honing of his argument. Mm. He had the matrix of evidence and persuasion to put this idea across. So he deserves most of the credit, and I'm happy to have a little bit of it, to share the limelight with him a little bit. This was Wallace in later years. As a matter of fact, when he eventually, he published a lot of books himself through the end of his life. He lived to be 90 and was writing almost to the end. And when Wallace himself finally wrote a book about natural selection, he titled it Darwinism. That was a reflection of his eagerness to give the major share of the credit to Mr. Darwin.
His eagerness and his generosity and his lack of ego.
Absolutely, exactly those things.
Yeah. David Quammen is our guest. David is a National Geographic contributing writer, and we're talking about a piece in the December issue on Alfred Russel Wallace. Our number, 800-486-8655. Thank you, Rich, for your call from Edgar. And we also have an email if you'd like to use that. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go back to phone calls for David Quammen. And let us go to Charlie is next from Wausau. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I see all this evidence for natural selection, and that's what Darwin saw on the island, natural selection. And this I agree with, and there, like I said, there's a ton of evidence for it, but the problem is natural selection does not create new species. This is the big thing. And kids are poured into this evidence of natural selection, but there's no connection. And I just want to say one more thing on this. Every so often we see a new skull shows up, and they say, ha-ha, here's the missing link between humans and apes. Well, the thing is, evolutionists say this happened over millions and millions and millions of years. We should not be finding one every 10 years or so. There should be thousands and thousands and thousands of them, and we're not finding that. There is huge problems with evolution, and I think that people who say that it's a fact need to at least admit this.
David.
Where should I start?
I don't know.
Charlie, thank you for your call. Charlie is a passionate adherent to the creationist view as opposed to the evolutionary view. The things he's saying have been said by others who share his views. The fact is that evolution by natural selection does create species. There's an argument that you hear from creationists sometimes Darwinian evolution can explain small-scale change, but not large-scale change, not speciation. Well, no, it does. And there are a number of forms of evidence that have ever more strongly supported that over the last 150 years. One of those forms of evidence is the fossil record. And we're constantly finding fossils that show gradation from one species to another. The fossil record is very spotty, and that's something that Darwin himself foresaw and devoted an entire chapter of The Origin of Species back in 1859 discussing the spottiness of the fossil record, because he knew that people would come along and say, hey, how come we don't have more evidence showing these transitions? What it takes to form a fossil of any species is for an individual animal, say, to fall dead and then be covered while it is still intact by a form of fine mud or silt, and for that mud or silt to be covered by other layers of mud or silt, for that to set up and turn into stone across millions and millions of years. And then for someone to come along after those millions of years and find that there is a road cut or there is a fissure in the earth that re-exposes that particular layer in the strata of rock, and happen along and find that fossil. So why don't we find even more fossils than we do? It's because those things have to happen. And yet, despite those factors against finding fossils, we have wonderful, persuasive series of incremental variation through the different taxa of primates leading toward humans, for instance, or mammals, reptiles. We have plenty of fossil evidence for these sorts of transitions. There's also a number of other forms of evidence, laboratory evidence, embryological evidence, biogeographical evidence. There's an overwhelming amount of evidence, but no body of evidence will ever persuade people to believe if they don't choose to believe.
Yeah. Let's go next to Pat from Lake Zurich, Illinois. Hi, Pat.
Hello.
Hello.
I'm interested in this discussion because I'm a Unitarian Universalist, and Darwin is what I consider one of my brothers in faith. He was a Unitarian at the time. And I'm wondering how, if your expert has any information on how this mix of religion and science fit into things. I know our Unitarian faith allows free exploration into any questions that we may have and doesn't prohibit any line of inquiry. And I'll take my answers off the air.
Okay, and while you're at it, if you can tell us, because we're talking about Wallace, too, what Wallace's thoughts about religion were.
Okay, yep.
All right, dude.
Wallace's thoughts about religion were generally that he was a non-believer. He didn't, as Darwin did, come from a religious background. He later in life had some unconventional, you might say, spiritual beliefs. For instance, he believed in spiritualism in the sense of seances, of contacting the dead through spirit mediums. He believed in mesmerism. He believed in phrenology, the study of character through shapes of skulls. But
what that word meant. I meant to look it up. I read it last night, and I asked everybody, what does that word mean? And we couldn't get it. Yes,
yeah.
Interesting, huh?
So Wallace, in his own way, was very spiritual, and a little bit, some of his colleagues thought he was just a little bit crankish or kooky when he got so interested in seances. And there was a great fad for seances in late 19th century Victorian England. Darwin himself sort of shook his head at that. He did not believe in spiritualism. And Darwin, as the caller said, came from a Unitarian background. Actually, his wife's family had been Unitarian. Darwin's own family, his father and his grandfather, had been free thinkers. They were not religious. But his wife's family were Unitarians. Darwin himself went to after dropping out of medical school in Edinburgh, he went to Cambridge University and did a degree there that was preparing him to become an Anglican minister. He wasn't very pious himself, but it was going to be a job, and he thought he needed to do something. And then when he went off on the voyage of the Beagle, he got pulled away from that and never went anywhere near being a minister when he came back to England. And eventually he described himself as an agnostic. But he was always very respectful of his wife's Christianity and piety. So although he seems to have found a conflict between Christianity and his ideas, his theory, he never forced that point on other people, and probably because it was very provocative, and he was he disliked controversy, and also because of his wife's beliefs.
If he disliked controversy, he got into the wrong business, didn't
he?
He
was dispositionally unfit for the role that he was called on to play.
Yeah. The picture, I want to get back to another picture here. There's this amazing picture of this flying frog, and it's in such detail. He's got these webbed feet that are yellow and red and green.
Oh, yeah.
Wallace, the caption is called Flying Frogs, Very Interesting to Darwinians. Why were they? Did he collected flying frogs too?
He saw frogs similar to this during his time in the Malay Archipelago.
Oh.
And it is a beautiful shot by
Robert. Yes, it is, yeah.
And these, it shows the frogs' feet spread open, and the feet are webbed like almost like umbrellas. And these frogs in the forests of Borneo and elsewhere in the Malay Archipelago escape from predators. They're tree frogs, and when they're in a tree and a snake or something comes up and they're threatened with being eaten, they launch themselves from the tree and they spread out their fingers and their toes, and they use this webbing between their fingers and their toes to glide to safety in some other place.
Mm.
They glide to the ground far distant from this predator, just the way a flying squirrel does. It doesn't actually fly, but it glides.
Mm-hmm.
So these are frogs that have become adapted to an escape mechanism like flying squirrels. Wallace realized that this adaptation was a continuation and exaggeration of the webbing that other frogs have in their feet that helps them to swim quickly.
Hmm.
So Wallace said, as the caption very concisely alludes to, that this was very interesting to Darwinians, this particular adaptation in frogs, because it showed how a character trait in one species that originally served one purpose could be modified and extended and enhanced to serve a completely different adaptive purpose.
Hmm.
And it shows that evolution works from what's available. Evolution doesn't work from scratch. It works from what's available. It's a historical process.
Mm-hmm. Don't you wish we could glide?
I do, yeah.
I do
well,
too.
We can. You know, I've never tried hang gliding or parapenting, but with a little bit of technological adaptation,
right.
we can do it.
We just can't do it naturally, though. It would be
right,
such a fun
yeah.
thing. And we all dream about it.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Maybe someday. Okay, let's go to Mary from Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I was wondering how old is Lucy, and how did they protect themselves? And something about her stature and banding, how they banded, and did they have fire?
Okay, it's Mary, right?
Yes.
Mary, you're taking me a little bit out of my,
right.
or more than a little bit out of my area of expertise into paleoanthropology. Lucy being the early form of, I can't remember which form of Homo, not maybe Homo erectus, but I'm not sure about that. Anyway, the early form of hominid found in, I'm going to take a rough guess and say Ethiopia, by Donald Johansson. My guess is that those fossils are dated at about several million, maybe 3 million years old. But again, everybody, forgive me if I've got these particular details wrong. She was a very important addition to the fossil record of hominid evolution. I don't think we know whether her species had fire. I would guess that they did not. And in terms of the social structure, how they banded together, again, it's probably something that even Donald Johansson would say, well, we just don't have enough evidence to say much about their social structure.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call. Dave, and we have about a minute left, everybody. Hi, Dave from Madison.
Yeah, just a quick question. I was just wondering, what did this Wallace, or I guess Darwin, I've never heard, what did they feel was, who or what started the origin of life? And I guess, who began the beginning and or what? And I guess I'd just like to get your guest's opinion
okay.
on
yep.
what he...
Okay. David.
Thanks, Dave. Big question, short period of time to answer it. Darwin and Wallace both admitted that the origin of life was a different question from the origin of the diversity of life, and that it was unanswerable. Darwin himself said that, well, we don't know what started life. All we can say is that once it had begun, this is how it diversified, adapted, and changed over time.
Hmm. Oh, you did that in a record amount of time. for such a huge question. Thank you, David, so much for being with us. It was really an interesting hour. Thank you.
You're welcome, Kathleen. I enjoyed it, too.
David Quammen, National Geographic contributing writer. And again, it's in the December 2008 issue of the magazine on the other Darwin, fascinating story of Alfred Russel Wallace. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. Tomorrow during this hour, again, a reminder, John Meacham is with us, editor of Newsweek magazine. Previously, I think this was the last time we talked with him. It was about his book, Franklin and Winston. He has a new book, American Lion, Andrew Jackson in the White House. So that's it for today. News is coming up from National Public Radio and many hours of great conversation ahead, so stay tuned, everybody. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9. It's a minute before 11 right now. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.